Accession number 28639, Reel 6.
Okay. So this is Jack Hewison, Reel 6.
So we're now moved into this hospital, this American school building.
And we're at the beginning of 1945. Have you any idea roughly where we are?
We just left Echioka in early 45 and moved to this. We've been bombed out of Echioka. And we're now moved into this building, which apparently was an old American school before the war. And it was a proper building with proper beds and what have you in it. So we were back into nearer civilization we'd ever seen for the most of our previous prisoner war period.
You still had the same commandant with you?
Different commandant. No, he had gone by this time. This was a Dr. Ohashi, a Japanese doctor, had taken over now this new building. Ohashi, O-H-A-S-H-I. And he was an old man, an old Japanese doctor, who showed a bit of sympathy for us, really, and apologised for all the previous experience that we had to go through. But he also explained why they couldn't get drugs, because there were apparently a great shortage on their own establishments for the same drugs. But he did try and get some of things in that were helpful for burns and things like that. But we were in this camp only, this was from about the spring of 45, I would say, we moved into this building. And it was getting near the end now, because the raids were becoming daily now, American raids. But during this period, we had a bit more of a diet, a bit more encouraging diet, to the extent that some of the Americans... This created problems because some of the Americans who were about to die didn't want their ration, and there was fights about who should take it. This was the other side of humanity within our own group, caused by the insanity, caused by starvation, I suppose. But mainly, again, Americans, again. Mainly because there were mostly Americans with me by this time. I was one, by this stage, of the only... three British people left in the group, the rest were all Americans in this camp. The others had either died or had been moved on to another camp when the bombing took place at Echioka. But what was I talking about now again? Dr. Hashi. He did try and help us a bit. But he made it quite clear there was limits to what he could do, for obvious reasons. But we did have these fights, as I was telling you about, and that was another problem we had, to try and sort that out. A number of times, for as weak as I was, I had to come between people and try and make them see sense. I said, you're only going to encourage the Japs to come in, and God knows what happened to all of us then, because they're all so touchy now about the war coming, hopefully, to an end. The end could happen to us. We're not going to throw it away now, after having been to struggle to survive all these years. And that worked most of the time. But eventually, one morning, and this was really getting near the end, we saw these sirens come on, and we heard this unusually heavy roar of planes. So we all dashed down to the little compound we had in this building. And for as far as we could see right and see left, and far as we could see forward, just these masses of white, look, birds coming towards us, silver birds, very low, that we could see the markings on them. It looked like Russians, because it wasn't the usual American things that we saw on the side of the plane. This, we saw this white star on a blue background with a dash through it, and that was uncommon to us. We just couldn't figure it out, and somebody said, it must be Russian. And he said, my God, huge planes. And then we realised they were dropping carpet bombing. So all the Japanese, of course, just disappeared. But we were so taken by the sight we were watching. We thought, this is it. This is what we've been waiting for all these bloody years. And we just stood there until we saw the actual shells coming down, and then we beat it for sure. But some of them came through the building we were in, and of course it caught fire in no time at all. And we finished up really carrying during the bombings, which had gone over us by this time, although the planes were still coming on, but they were waiting to drop the next load, I suppose. They were just carpet bombers that were going on. And we were carrying people out, and I was in this building, and I had a chap on my back to carry. I gave him a fireman's lift, actually, as best I could, was as weak as I was, when this bomb came through the ceiling. And it lifted me and the chap I was carrying off the floor against the wall, and I was blinded. And I thought I had lost my sight, and I panicked. But this same guy that saved my life earlier in Ethiopia, whom I've become like a blood brother to, right up until he died, my brother, number of times he's been over here and I've been over at his house, he got hold of me. He was a medic, and he said, "Jack, if I can..." Huey, they call me. Jackson or Huey, one or the other. "Huey, if I can prove that you can still see..." He said, "Your face is swollen because of the blast. If I can prove..." He said, "Well, you just shut up and let's get on with getting other people out of here." Because by this time he got us out into the hillside above the building. And he pushed it. It was painful, he said, but it was... And I could see. That was all thanks. I said, "That's all." He said, "You'll just lie there now." And off he went. So eventually he came back, and I was beginning to see a little bit. The swelling was starting to go down. And I realised I'd got away with it very luckily. But then the Japs, when that wave was over, they sorted us out once more. Those who could walk, and I was one of those who could walk, went off on a march further up the hill. Oh no, sorry, I got that wrong. Those who could walk went up to another camp called, Mariyama. But I was one who could walk, so I was left. And we went on another transport. God knows why they had transport, because we could walk. But then they took us to this camp called Miyoshi, which turned out to be just outside Hiroshima, where the bomb was dropped. Miyoshi, M-I-Y-O-S-H-I. And I was the only remaining one from the former camps that was still surviving in this camp. I was on my own by this time. I don't know what happened. It was a confusion by the Japanese at the end, sorting people out. But I finished in this camp where it was a mixture of like Portuguese, Dutch, and Indians. There was all sorts in this camp.
Civilians?
No, there were people from a hospital ship, apparently. So I was told, because I was only there a very short time. This is just on the last days of the war, really. I was in this camp, and we're having this roll call in the morning. And I was standing, waiting to be numbered. H-E-N-E, San, C, go. We had to a number in Japanese still. And they said, everybody had been trained to do numbering. They just couldn't pick Japanese. We knew all the Japanese for the roll calls, like attention and keeping quiet and moving and all that. And he was up on this rather new commandant, was up on this box. They all had their boxes, and his sword by his side. And he was in the middle of reminding us that we were about to be exterminated, because the Japanese, every man, woman, and child would be required to defend Japan to the last woman and child on the island. When suddenly, in a lovely, beautiful, sunny morning, cloudless sky, the place lit up. It just lit up as if, well, we just couldn't believe it. And at the same time, or seconds afterwards, this horrendous rush of hot air that nearly took us off our feet, just as if we'd suddenly been confronted with a furnace. And the guards just stood up and mouthed around us. But the commandant, he stopped what he was saying, got off his box, lifted his box, and just disappeared. God knows why. We all thought we must have hit, the Americans must have hit a munitions dump. That's all we could think of. But soon after that, there was this peculiar voice on the radio. And to this day, I'm not sure what he said, but he knew something was on. And the very next morning, they came and...
You didn't see a cloud? You didn't see the, You didn't see the mushroom cloud?
No. Well, I saw the cloud, yeah, but that didn't mean anything to us. We could just see the top of it. And it was just like, we sat on mission. All the things we could think of, because we didn't know anything about atomic bombs or anything.
How far away were you from the...
Oh, a good 20 miles, maybe more than that, because we're on the outskirts of Hiroshima, right on the outskirts.
So this air was almost too hot. I mean,
we felt the heat from the hot air. And it not only felt it but physically, but it moved us. We all sort of went to one side. It was just like a huge draft of a heavy wind. So we knew that was something very, very bad. It must have been a terrific explosion. But the next morning...
And then life continued as usual in the camp that day. We just went back to the usual routine.
Well, no, the guards were very... They were still there, but they were very, how shall I put it, silent. They just didn't speak. There was no orders. They just pointed to us to what they wanted us to do. You know. But the next morning, they came and said, you come, you go in the truck.
Sorry, Jack, I interrupted you before. It's my fault. You were saying there was a peculiar voice over the radio.
Oh, yes. We never did find out. Well, later on, I'll tell you what that was. That happened later on.
But you had a radio then, at this stage?
Yeah. No, not a radio. No, this was... We had a...
PA system.
A public address system from the camp, mainly for the guards, from the guardhouse. And we knew that something was on, but we didn't know what it was. We went into Hiroshima the next morning with this working party, 12 of us. And we were told to pick up what was left of human beings. It was quite horrendous. The first thing we noticed when we went in, there was no roads, because everything had just been swept. And the cables were lying on the ground, so sparking. We saw what was left. We were just on the outskirts of Hiroshima. We didn't get any farther than the outskirts, because we had so much to do in the 3 days. We were only there 3 days. We were told where we were going to sleep, and this, what was left of a railway station. The roof had gone, the windows had gone, but the metal, the concrete part was still standing, and we'd see flashes of, like shadows of human beings. We found out after that was where human beings had been penetrated into the wall. Quite incredible, really, scenes. So I was picking up, oh, by the way, we weren't allowed to touch humans that were still alive. Any Japanese were to signal to Japanese. We saw something, by the way, just recently on BBC television about Hiroshima, and I saw the Japanese officer laying instructions that actually was there with me, but I didn't see myself or any of the prisoners. Now, he was in Hiroshima, so he must have been in the same area that I was. Well, they were there to look after any Japanese that were still alive. So any that was dead, we had to pick them up and put them on this sort of hand truck we had. And some of them were just like pieces of charcoal. I remember one instance where I was picking up this piece, about to pick it up, when one of the Americans that was with me said, that's a piece of a building, put it down. But I said, no, it isn't. And I looked it close, and it was what was left of a woman holding a baby. And you could just see the images, just in the, like, charcoal image of a baby. It was quite horrendous. I mean, it was so horrendous that I, honestly, for those few seconds, I forgot all about my previous experiences as a Japanese piano. I was with those people in Hiroshima from their second on. And for the next, all that day, all we did was pick up what was left. And we weren't allowed to put them in the grave, and we took them to a point and just put them in a heap. I don't know, I can only assume they'd burn them eventually. But the Japanese that were still alive, and some of them were in a hell of a state. There was people with eyes hanging out, and they were still contacted to the inside. Oh, it was, Christ, I think it was quite horrific, it was, really. And they were just taken away, and what was meant to be ambulances was just any military Japanese trucks that they had around. That went on for the first day.
And everybody was, I imagine, in a complete state of shock.
We spent all that time just going over an area of maybe 100 square yards, that was all. All that day.
Were there other work parties as well?
There was others, but we could just see them in the distance. And we were so taken by what we were meeting up with, we just didn't have time to speak to them. Everything was so horrific. We were just speechless. We just couldn't believe what we were looking at. And that night we couldn't sleep. The next morning we were up, as soon as it was daylight. By the way, we didn't get to bed until it was dark. No food. Up the next morning, was still no food. Out again. That went on for 2 days. And on the third morning, we just got out of bed and getting ready for the third day, when the Japanese officer that I said I saw on that thing, that car, he came and said, he could speak a bit of English, he said, "You all now go home." And we, oh, the war's over. So we got back on the truck, but when we got back on the truck back to the camp, we realised, we were told then, the war's not over, you're just back in the camp, that's all. But we found out afterwards why we'd been sent back home, because that was the day the third bomb was dropped in Nagasaki, and they were afraid of a huge Japanese uprising. And they changed from exterminating what was left of the POWs into looking after us, to try and save their own skins. That was the change.
There was no animosity to you when you were in Hiroshima?
No, but on the third day they were worried when that third bomb dropped. They were worried about that.
The second bomb, right.
Mm. On the third day. That's right, they were afraid of it then. And by the way, the threes always come into this. It made me think of Jesus Christ, you know. The third day he rose again. I mean, you'd be amazed at how I restored my faith in that Ethiopia camp with that priest. And just briefly, I tried to contact that priest. His name was Father Green. Father Green. And every time I contacted him, he just left in a new address. And this went on for years. And just 5 years ago, I managed to find where he was in Canada. And he was in his late 80s. And I got to him, but he had died just the year before. So I was so disappointed. I'd love to have thanked him if I'd met him up with him. But that was it. But anyway, that was Hiroshima. So we're back in this camp. And just to finish up the recording.
Any
questions about
Hiroshima? Yeah, I mean, this is an extraordinary event that you've witnessed. Not many, you know.
I've been told by John Booth I'm the only British civilian that they know of, or serviceman that was ever in Hiroshima immediately after the bomb was dropped.
When you drove in, if you don't mind, we could talk as much as we can about this.
Yes, right, as much as you like. Cause
so you drove in from the camp into Hiroshima, in towards this area of the centre of the bomb, where the bomb went off. Well, you said you got to the outskirts.
Yeah, well, it was only the outskirts we were ever in, really. So that's all I saw.
And was that absolutely flattened?
Yes, it was. The outskirts, right up to the outskirts. It was really awful. I'm trying to think of some of the incidents that I saw there that...
People walking around with terrible injuries.
Yes, they were walking around with burns and, oh, it's quite horrible. There's no skin on them, ribs showing where they're taking the skin straight away, and there's bare ribs showing. It was horrendous. I can't find the words to explain the horrific scenes I saw.
People panicking.
Oh, yeah, everybody panicked.
This is 24 hours after.
Once I will tell you, there was... And those days of the Japanese, they still had the very primitive type of firefighting, by the way. They had static water tanks up on stilts. And when there was a fire in the area, people went up the ladder and just passed buckets down, and the bucket went by hand. And the last one threw the water on the thing. Now, we were told to go up those ladders and see if there's any bodies in there. And we went up the ladder, and I was one of those who went up the ladder. And there was people in there, and you grabbed an arm and a leg to pull them to one side, and it just came away. They'd been boiled. Just the arm of this body was still all right, it'd been cooked. But it just came away, the arm and the leg. Quite horrific experiences, really.
And people...
Well, I just left them there. I came down.
Civilians that survived, were they screaming? Were they just...
Oh, yes, shocked? Everybody. Well, there was some screaming and some were just going around numb, just moaning. There was tremendous moaning. I always remember that. You could hear it from miles around, just, oh, 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 that sort of noise.
This is 24 hours afterwards, isn't it?
That was 24 hours afterwards, yeah.
Completely chaotic scene.
Yeah. And by the way, I was affected by it, as you'll find out later, because just to finish my story... When the Americans came in, American Marines came into our camp.
I don't want to jump ahead. Do you mind? It's a fascinating period. So you work 3 days, and then the Japanese officer says you go home.
You go
back to the camp.
I went back in the transport we came on, back to the camp. Just an open truck.
And what was going on in the camp?
Well, they wanted to know what it was. We said, we don't know. We tried to tell him the site, and there was he's dead now. Dr. Page was a British doctor in charge in this particular camp at the time in this building. And he He said it must have been something horrific. He said, from the scenes you've just told us, we can only just wait. He said, but nobody must go outside of this camp while I'm still in charge here, because we've got to wait till the Americans or the British arrive. So that was all we could do on that visit to Hiroshima at that stage. But then the Americans came in, the Marines came in first. And this big burly sergeant again.
How long was that after the bomb? Can you remember?
Oh, yeah, the day after.
The day after?
No, hang on.
You cleaned up for 3 days.
It was 3 days, that's right. We'll get this right. It was a 3 day. No, it was a good 3 to 4 days afterwards. Some of them went out, by the way, tried to get into Hiroshima, but they were stopped by the Japanese on the way, so they didn't get in there.
And your guards had gone?
The guards had gone. There were no guards around, but they had disappeared.
The commandant had gone?
No, everybody gone.
Dr. Hashi?
They'd all disappeared. Everybody. There was nobody. It's just the whole world had changed to us. The whole scene had changed completely. And then these Americans came in. They were all yellowing, and throwing chocolate and cigarettes.
Can you describe that moment when you first...
Oh, it was hilarious.
The jeep came through the gate.
Well, it was a combination of the Americans trying to throw food to us. And by the way, they were dropping food by big canisters as well from B-29s. And that was dangerous, coming through the roofs of buildings where the parachutes hadn't opened. And Page, it was a case of the Americans telling us to eat up, you deserve it, you poor bastards, between kids. And for God's sake, these men haven't eaten for years. They can't eat to this extent. And he was trying to, and there was this battle going on, there was never any compromise existed, which just went on and on, as far as I can remember. The American community throwing in chocolate there. And the first things they did was they went up, and we'll never forget, this was a real ceremony. Everybody cried. And when we were crying, even the American Marines cried with us. When they pulled down that Japanese flag, the fried egg, as we called it, and that was silence. But when we saw the American flag going up, there was tears of joy. Still to this day, when I see that American flag, I still cry, because that meant freedom to me. My wife can't understand it because she doesn't like Americans. But I can't help loving that flag. A star and stripe meant freedom to me. Anyway, then the American medic people came, and they took over. They agreed with Dr. Page and said, no more of this big eating. You've got to control your eating from now on. And they said, first thing they want is we want to segregate some people. There's been a terrible bomb in the city just outside where you've just come from. We don't know anything about it ourselves at this stage, but we know it was horrendous. So we want to, and they knew what it was, but they didn't want to tell us at the time. This is what we found out afterwards. They said, we want all those people who have been into the city of Hiroshima to put their hands up. Now, all you move over to that side, moved us, all the segregated. The rest of them went away in trucks to Yokohama and Olive Base for a journey home. We were taken by plane from there to Okinawa, first of all. And this is another story which you'll be interested in. Okinawa was a part of Japan, of course, and it had been badly burnt, so there was no buildings really left, and the Americans put up huge hospital tents. And there was even the bands of the day, the big bands like, what's his name, the clarinet player... Tommy Dorsey was one. His band was there. Bands like that were big bands, and they played all the time we were in there. Not all of them, but there was some more in the next stop when I went from there. But Tommy Dorsey was one that I remembered there. Whether it was his whole band or not, I'll never know. But I know they were playing the old songs.
How did you cope with the change? I
mean, it was from this. Well, it was so quick. It was just we were in a daze. We just couldn't. Accept what was happening to us. It was very difficult, believe me, it was, after all these years. We just sat back and just accepted it all. But anyway, in this camp, I went in there. The first thing I noticed in this was there was Japanese medics and American medics working together. And I thought, what the hell's going on here? So the first thing I said, why are we in here? What have I done that's made me not be on my way home? And this American doctor said, you have just experienced a horrific experience, one that will live with you for the rest of your life. You have just been a survivor from the atomic bomb. I said, the what? He said, the atomic bomb. I said, what's an atomic bomb? He said, you'll find out later. But it's been so bad that you're a special patient. You've got to be examined. And they examined us and they said, that my hands were badly burned. They managed to get my hands claw, but they said, you will suffer badly from your bad knee. I'll tell you that. You'll eventually have to have a knee replacement or something done to your knee. But he said, the rays have affected your inside and you will not be able to father any children. So I've never been able to father any children. But I was very lucky later because I met my wife through my first appointment as a civil servant in this country. I was appointed to Scarborough in Yorkshire, and the hairdresser that looked after me for the first two or three months when I went for a haircut eventually asked me to go to her husband's dinner dance, and I said, but I haven't got a partner. Now, this was several years after the war, and I had been posted to the early warning system in Farthingdales eventually. And it was while I was there that I was into Scarborough doing this hairdressing stunt and living in Scarborough. And she said, well, my sister's coming. I said, I've got a patch and my sister's coming. So I said, is she married? She said, she was. She just divorced her husband. So I said, right, I'll go for a partner. I fell in love with her as soon as I met my wife. But I didn't know when I met her that she had three young children, the younger four. And the second was six and the oldest one was only 12. So I'd... She apparently, her husband was a school teacher and given one of the child and his class a baby, one of the girls in his class a baby, and she kicked him out. She's still up there now. And there I was with four kids, the oldest 12. And at first I had a lot of trouble with the oldest boy. The youngest, two youngest one, no problem. But the oldest boy eventually came round, and now we couldn't be a closer family. And I thank God again, Jesus Christ, for giving me that ready-made family. But anyway, back to... Yokohama.
So you were actually burnt by the blast.
Yes, well, I was. I wasn't aware of it at the time. That's the burns I've got there.
They were treated
afterwards, yeah.
And they said that...
I was treated in Yokohama, in Okinawa.
What kind of treatment?
2 weeks I was in there.
What kind of treatment would they give you?
Well, I don't know. There was x-rays and all similar type of x-rays they did. Oh, it wasn't quite 2 weeks. I was in there about 7 or 8 days, really, on Okinawa. And then they said, now we've got to go down to Manila now for further treatments. They've got better equipment down there. So it was another...
To
Manila in the Philippines. So another flight down to the Philippines in another C-47 or Dakota-type aircraft. It only went up to about 10,000 feet and it was bumpy all the way. Went down there another week there. And the same examinations, only different types of examinations. They put things in my mouth on the ends of pieces of thread I had to swallow, and then they pulled it up afterwards. This was to test for worms in my stomach, I believe, or things. But I was sick when they brought it out, I'll tell you. But then from there, after a week there, unless there's any questions you want to ask me.
No, I'm just curious. You were going back to that moment when the Americans first arrived in the camp. And they saw you, what a condition you were all in.
Yeah.
And these well-fed, healthy Americans. What, they must have been horrified.
Oh, they were,
indeed.
Compassion, they were. Well, they all wanted to give you cigarettes, of course, the Americans. I didn't smoke, so fortunately they didn't mean anything to me. I was a chocolate lover. I had much chocolate as they wanted to give me, but I wouldn't like to eat it.
But this kind of exchange between these people must have looked at you and realised what you'd
been
through.
Oh, they were wonderful, the Americans. They were, really.
And you must have wanted to tell them your story,
yes.
I suppose.
I'll tell you just briefly. Since I've been to Japan, only just about 10 years ago, I went on a trip back to Pearl Harbor. I wanted to visit Pearl Harbor because that's where it all started.